Hello and welcome to the Case for Conservation podcast, where we investigate some of the underexplored but important topics in nature conservation. I'm your host, Andre Marder. Before I introduce today's guest, Happy New Year for 2021. I know that 2020 was a more difficult year than most for many people for COVID-related reasons. So here's hoping that 2021 is a much more positive and fulfilling year for everybody. For today's episode, my guest is Deborah Roberts. Deborah is an ex-colleague of mine who works both in local government and in international organizations. She works in policy, in science, and in implementation, and her focus covers both biodiversity and climate change. She's co-chair of one of the working groups of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, and she was recently named one of the 100 most influential people in climate policy, alongside Al Gore, David Attenborough, and a number of other big names. We talk about cities and the surprisingly profound role that they have to play in conservation, from the steps of City Hall all the way to the depths of the Amazon jungle. I wanted to actually start off by asking how you became involved and interested in conservation, and perhaps you can add climate change to that question, because I know that that's the biggest part of your work at the moment.
I think that question really is answered best by going back to childhood. You know, I was one of the lucky kids born on the African continent, grew up in the bush, and so I suppose an inclination towards conservation was in the DNA from the earliest days, even though I probably didn't know it at that point. I was born in Zimbabwe and finished my high school there, decided to move to South Africa to go to university because the kind of courses I wanted to focus on, which were in the biological sciences and a more integrated approach to the study of biology, were only offered in South Africa at the time. But firmly convinced that I would end up in a career focusing on things like biochemistry. So I kind of imagined myself in a lab somewhere. But then I suppose that DNA came to the fore when we went on our second year field trip up to Mtanzini. And I met Ian Garland there, who was a sugarcane farmer, who was deeply troubled by the fact that he could no longer swim in the stream that he used as a young boy. And so was making a strong case for conservation in the agricultural landscape. And I knew then that the lab was not part of my future, and focusing on that sort of work was what interested me. So I suppose there was an early tendency not only to conservation, but conservation in fragmented land. And then the deal was really sealed when I entered upon my honours studies, and one of my supervisors was one of Africa's best herpetologists, and he was particularly concerned about the loss of frogs in Durban, and kind of sent me out to look at that. And the moment you start working in cities, you embrace fragmented landscapes as part of that. And so my PhD was very much on urban conservation in the city of Durban. I completed my PhD, thought I was then going to spend my life as a university researcher and lecturer, but only managed to get through 3 years of that and was very disillusioned, because I realized that while I'd been fortunate at the PhD level, having a supervisor who was very visionary about biology, conservation, and where those two things could play out, the university wasn't necessarily so, and I didn't think valued applied research adequately. So as the country moved to democracy, I thought, if a country can change, I can change too. So I packed up my academic bags and joined local government. So I've been with Durban in Itakwini Municipality for almost 3 decades now. And as part of that, really drove the initial urban conservation work the city is renowned for, but took a sabbatical in 2004 and went to Brown University, to the Watson Institute. And there bumped into people working in the field of climate change, realized that we had missed serious beat. And that's where I picked up on climate change and have continued to work in the field of climate change adaptation. So that's it in a nutshell.
So you actually didn't have anything to do with climate change until you went to Brown in the early 2000s?
No, in fact, the climate change agenda obviously had started way back at the first Rio conference in 1992. It had been bubbling around through the work that ICLEI had done, but it really never settled, at least into my mind, as something that cities needed to prioritize, because we had so many other challenges after 1994 with the political change, the huge developmental gaps. You know, I really couldn't see where climate change fitted into that very urgent agenda. It was only after I had the time to deeply engage with the science, and so I suppose I remain a scientist at heart, that I realized I had missed a beat. And the one thing I'm very good at, when I realize I've made a mistake, I work rapidly to correct it.
I thought that because the audience of the podcast is pretty international, many might not know very much about eThekwini, and you have mentioned Durban and eThekwini in the same sentence. Could you maybe just explain a bit more about eThekwini as a city and how that relates to Durban?
Okay, yes, certainly the name conundrum is a familiar one. So effectively, I work in a city called Durban, but it is managed and planned and overseen by a local government known as eThekwini Municipality. So the distinction is we've got a city called Durban, we've got a local government called eThekwini Municipality, but certainly in the colloquial, many people will just refer to the city as eThekwini City.
How would you describe that municipality to people who haven't visited South Africa and even Africa, who might be thinking of a city as an entirely built-up area? Because it's very different there, isn't it? It's even very different to Cape Town, where I'm from.
Yeah. So, I mean, Durban, I suppose, is in many ways a characteristic African city. If you look at the pattern of urbanization around the continent, a lot of it is focused around rivers and coastlines. It's the largest port and city on the east coast of Africa. So a lot of the trade with the continent happens through our port. So it's a major connector to the remainder of the southern African region. So the port is a very important part of the identity of our city. It has a strong urban core, which in many ways is very similar to city centres you might see around the world. And indeed, our city hall is a replica of Belfast City Hall, which is a strong indicator of the links to the colonial history of our continent. But you don't have to drive terribly far before Africa creeps up on you. A large portion of our municipal area is under traditional leadership and is overseen by the Ingonyama Trust Board. So the Ingonyama is the Zulu king, and he is the sole member of the trust. And the land under the trust is managed under the custodial care of various traditional leaders throughout the city. So we've got 14 traditional leadership areas, and they are responsible for a significant portion of our municipal area. So quite different to a more Western setup where City Hall is the key anchor of power. In our city, we definitely have two forms of governance, the Western form and City Hall, but then this traditional form of leadership, which is really important to us because the Ingonyama Trust and the traditional leaders who manage the land of the trust within the municipal area are largely located in our upper catchment areas. So very important pieces of land if we are thinking about the overall sustainability and resilience of the city.
In preparation for the podcast discussion, you mentioned to me that a bugbear of yours is how cities are not recognized fully for the role that they play in conservation. How would you explain why cities are even relevant for conservation? And feel free to throw climate change into the mix there if you like as well.
You know, to me, that sort of question always provokes a return question. So what is conservation? And I don't think we should see conservation as something that stands alone, that's external to us. Conservation is important because it's about human well-being. You know, we don't conserve outside of the need to improve human well-being to ensure our sustainability as a species. And I think that's an important element of conservation that gets lost in the mix sometimes, as we've forgotten that conservation is about us and our well-being. And if that's a central thesis of why we conserve, and a central part of why we're interested in conservation, then you have to look to cities. You know, it's just the fact is we are now an urban species. So the majority of people in the world live in cities. And so if you are interested in capturing the imagination of people around rare species, about forests far away, of distant grasslands and deserts, you're going to have something identifiable near them in order that they understand that connection to these faraway places, that they become part of a decision-making cycle, a resource allocation cycle, a governance cycle that then decides favorably about those places far away. You are not going to get high-level decision-makers who live in cities going into their city halls, to their national-level parliaments, their state-level congresses, and voting for and on behalf of and allocating resources to the conservation of distant areas unless they feel some kind of connection to that. And they get that connection from where they live. So that's the first and important thing. Conservation is about people, and people now live in cities. So if you ignore cities, you're ignoring conservation. So you've got to be able to speak to people in cities, which means they need nature in all of its forms nearby them. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think we often look at conservation as this very static type of endeavor where the world has a certain layout and we want to protect certain elements of that layout. So to protect the status quo. And quite frankly, we know because of climate change and a lot of the global change literature that that's not the case. The world is extremely dynamic. It's changing very rapidly. We also know that our cities, particularly our small and medium-sized cities, are growing very rapidly. I think the urban area will triple in the period 2000 to 2030. And so these cities, be they the big mega cities of the world or probably more importantly, the small and medium-sized cities around the world, are literally growing up in places. They have a geography. And what do cities do? They transform land. And in transforming land, it then becomes harder to affect protection of nature, the securing of ecosystem services. And this is problematic in a dynamic world because we know, because of climate change, that ecosystems and species are beginning to shift their ranges to begin to adapt to the changes. So things need to move. It's really hard for you to move through several kilometers of solid concrete if that stands in your way. And we know from the research that a lot of this urban growth is happening in biodiverse regions, particularly in Africa and particularly in Asia. So this is a very real concern. If you're not concerned about people and capturing their imagination around conservation, you need to be practically concerned that cities are expanding the areas, they're converting land, and in a very dynamic world, species are going to battle to move through that concrete environment, particularly if cities are located in biodiversity hotspots. And South Africa is an excellent example, one of the three most biodiverse countries in the world. And look at where all the cities are located. They're located in the biodiversity hotspots in the country. So even if you're a purist, you need to be concerned. But then the third motivation is one that really comes from my scientific background, which is if this world is changing, you know that status quo is not going to remain. The world of novel ecosystems is upon us. And so in many ways, cities are the test tubes. They are the places where the first novel ecosystems are beginning to emerge at scale. And so they allow us to peer into conservation's future. And in fact, you know, I, for most of my biodiversity career, was very much a strict biodiversity conserve sort of person. And then I had one of those aha moments. That I had an aha moment about climate change, realizing that we needed to think about this dynamism and really set up an element in the department that I ran at the time to look at management, to look at the novel ecosystems, to begin to understand them, because I suspect those novel ecosystems are the biodiversity of the future.
Last discussion that I had on the podcast was with Michelle Marvia, and she, that podcast was basically all about the notion that conservation is being a bit too conservative in terms of risk-taking, especially. And she was talking about, you know, the fact that because global change is happening as fast as it is, we need to be a little bit more proactive, I suppose, in terms of the risks that we take and in terms of the ways that we fiddle with nature, especially in contexts like cities. And the examples that she gave included alien species, and they included genetic modification. And she was saying how we have to recognize that the cost of inaction can be greater than the cost of action. But also very much from the perspective of embracing the idea of novel ecosystems and of, I guess, a little bit more gardening nature.
I mean, and I agree with that. I think the jury's still out on the genetic modification. But, you know, we use the term Anthropocene for a reason. Effectively, our species is the first species to take control of the levers that drive this planet or spaceship Earth. You know, so we literally are in the driving seat. I suspect we don't have our learner's license. But if you are going to pick up that responsibility, you are talking about a heavily modified planet. And so this idea of standing back, I think, on conservation is a dangerous one in such a rapidly changing world. But at the same time, I think you can manage risk by engaging that exploration in places like urban areas, mm-hmm. which are set up for that. They're places of change. And so I think one can explore what that actually means. You know, what do novel systems look like? What kind of biodiversity can they support? You know, what do they add in terms of sustainability and resilience? So to my mind, urban areas are an amazing opportunity to get ahead of that game and explore with minimized risk what that level of intervention might involve.
In terms of helping species move through cities, you know, you mentioned that as one of your points. Are you referring specifically to corridors, wildlife corridors and biodiversity corridors in their various shapes and forms?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the discussion around what nature in cities might look like is evolving rapidly. Certainly, we're seeing nature-based solutions emerging as important opportunities for improved resilience and adaptation and mitigation, both from the biodiversity assessments and the climate assessments that are being done. And so that's really forcing us to think about how we want to see nature or biodiversity in the cities. And so there's definitely the traditional view of green infrastructure, which is about, you know, bringing in your street trees and your green roofs and all of those good things. But then I think we are also talking about trying to create viable ecosystems that can be corridors or transit points for species that are changing their ranges, which really points to the need to have biodiversity in its indigenous state, whatever that might mean at the time, being present and functional. And depending on the nature of your ecosystem, you know, that may mean different things. So in Cape Town, with the nature of the fynbos down there, you can probably create a corridor by connecting two city blocks together, because that's the nature of those small communities that need linkages. Whereas in some place like Durban, where you've got bigger forested ecosystems, you probably need more substantial riverine corridors to affect that kind of landscape continuity. But it's really about bringing nature back into cities in ways that are not necessarily traditional, and really thinking of a closer blend between the grey infrastructure and the green infrastructure, which I think is where the debate is going.
Generally speaking, you're talking about ecosystems rather than individual large species and keystone species, creating green across cities as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about creating the functional whole. And so, you know, many of the larger animals obviously sort of apex predators, and they require a functional whole, which means you need soil and the billions of bacteria and fungi that make that functional, which link then to the grasslands on top of it, which bind in that carbon, which then provide the ecotones that allow the shrubs to grow up and then support the forests. And it's that whole dynamic which we need to create space for in the context of our cities. And if you are successful, then, you know, ultimately you may spot, for example, a leopard in Durban. We had a trail known as the Ngweni Trail. It's part of the original Durban Metropolitan Open Space System. And Ngweni means leopard, because leopards were coming into the heart of the city. But the idea is to break down that notion. If you think about where cities came from 6,000 years ago, They were created for a variety of reasons, obviously settlement and trade, but an important part of urban architecture was the wall. It was to keep out the dangers, and those dangers were both human, but also wild nature. And so somewhere in our psyche, we've lost the ability to see cities as a fluid component within a natural landscape and embracing that. And we need to break down both the metaphorical and physical walls of our cities to allow functioning ecosystems to come back in. And they will bring a whole host of things with them, depending on the landscapes they're in. Not necessarily the apex predators, of course, but it's that functionality that you're really striving for, because that builds the resilience into your landscapes. It improves your adaptive capacity, the ability for those functioning ecosystems to bind carbon into the soil, to absorb floodwaters, to provide resources such as wood for energy, the opportunity for food collection, to reduce temperatures. And, you know, if they are functional, then that reduces the management costs that come with them. Obviously, doesn't obviate them in its entirety. With things like climate change, we know the impact of alien invasive species is a tremendous one, so they need to be managed. Where they impact on things like water supply. But it's that thinking, it's the breaking down of the mental barriers about what is grey and what is green, and really seeing cities replaced into the natural landscape rather than excluding the natural landscape.
You've touched there on why it's valuable for people to have such areas in cities. I'm reminded of an example in Montreal where a study was done on the value of properties in relation to their proximity to parks. And not surprisingly, you pay a lot more for an apartment whose windows face onto a park than the apartment behind that that faces away from it. So simple little things like that, in addition to the more fundamental examples that you just provided now.
But I think it goes beyond that in African cities. So we did some work with the World Bank a couple of years back where they revised the valuation of our open spaces in the city. And the bulk of that valuation came from the amenity value, because that's what people value in cities, is that inherent connection to nature, to get into nature. And we saw this during COVID, you know, while people were restricted to their houses. As soon as restrictions are lifted, wherever you were in the world, people were going out into the green spaces to try and connect. And so that's the thing. We're still an animal that needs connection to its natural environment. So I think that's an important part of it. And that amenity is a critical part of that. But if you look at an African city like Durban, you've got just under 600 informal settlements. And so very often, if you look at the nature of informality as a critical part of African urbanization, those are communities that are often directly dependent on nature for meeting their basic needs. And, you know, I've often said during my career, there certainly have been some communities in Durban where I think nature is a bigger service provider than local government, simply because we can't get our bulk sewers and bulk water mains and electricity pylons out to some areas. And so nature then steps in, as it were, to provide that. So there's a strong amenity value and that hedonic value that you get from having a property close to an attractive green space, be it managed or more natural. That's an important part of it. But certainly in Africa, the direct reliance on nature as a service provider when government can't necessarily provide those basic services is a critical one. I mean, you can see it if you go to Kampala and their reliance on the wetlands. You know, we saw it when we visited some of the informal settlements in Dar es Salaam. It's a common story in Africa's cities. I think you can see it in many of the Indian cities. If you go to Kolkata and look at the role of the mangroves, the Sundarban there as protecting. So, you know, I think where you've got cities that are in the processes of development, nature's often standing alongside local government as a critical service provider to your poorest and most vulnerable.
And then in the more developed cities, that reliance has been transferred to other parts of the world, distant to cities, which kind of brings us back to the first point that you made, which was the importance of, I guess, reaching the audience of people that are in cities and reconnecting them with nature. The conservation psychology literature talks about how we need to, as you said, we need to have some kind of connection with nature in order to recognize its importance. But I wanted to just ask, even though you've already given some good examples of how we demonstrated that reliance, why do you think people can't just be shown a David Attenborough video and given some important facts and, you know, the latest assessment summary and be told, you know, this is important, please take note? Why do you think we need that additional physical connection with nature in order to be advocates for nature?
Yeah, so I'm certainly not a specialist in psychology and wouldn't claim to know what the science is about it, but I can just draw on my own personal experience. As I indicated in the introduction, I was born in Zimbabwe in a city called Bulawayo, and it's a very dryland landscape, dryland, thornveld, savanna, and there's a particular smell and sound to that landscape which is unique to it. And I just have to smell that and hear that noise, and I'm back in my childhood. Now, there's no science that can explain to me why that happens, but I know that that is just, for me, it's momentous. And in fact, I mean, my schedule is always incredibly busy, but I know when I had opportunities to go up to Pretoria to the CSIR campus, that's quite close to that kind of dry land landscape and that smell. And I would always make time for meetings in Pretoria on that campus, not because I thought the meeting was important, but because it was the opportunity to hear and smell something that is really important to me. And I think it's that human connection that we can bring all the most wonderful scientists in the world to try and explain it away, but it's something instinctual. It's something wonderful. It's a link that, as I say, we're just simply an animal, and that's ultimately where we came from. And I think there's always that internal hankering after it, and that'll be with me till my dying day. Is that smell and that sound will always be something that I deeply value.
You hear stories of policymakers who are taken for a 1 or 2 day trip to the Amazon or some wild place, which completely changes the way that they do business. And obviously a policymaker's business is very important because they're decision makers on whatever level, city level or nation level. So it strikes me that what you're talking about and the information side of things are kind of two sides of the same coin, or two ingredients to the recipe to get people to make that connection, the facts and then the feeling. And I know exactly what you mean. I've experienced it myself, and I'm sure that a lot of listeners have experienced that as well. But I guess that in cities, even though there are all these opportunities and growing opportunities perhaps to experience nature, there are also a lot of cities that don't have that opportunity, and a lot of people in cities who don't make the time to make that connection.
But I think it's accessibility. You know, and I think that's where a lot of work needs to be done, because I think you've made the correct linkage there. Information is one thing, but information can be overwhelming in a world where we are constantly bombarded. I mean, I work at the science policy interface, and I am bombarded by so much information. I don't know what to do with it. And in fact, I've got to the point where some days I don't want to hear anything anymore just because I'm so overwhelmed. So I think information is important, but it only, I think, really reaches home and has an impact in terms of the way I live my life if it's linked to the other experiential elements of value. And there I think we need to make these areas more accessible to people. So I think they can, you know, be present in cities, but people can't easily access them. And that calls into mind, does our public transport get people there? Is it safe? Do we have appropriate governance which is ensuring security in those areas? You know, do we have enough resources that when we get people there, the opportunity to convey that information through educational centers is made available to them? So, you know, I think if we acknowledge that information and access to the experiential side is really important, it requires mobilization of, in the case of cities, a whole level of governance and integration of that governance to pull those two things together. And I think that's where the slip-ups are happening. Yes, you can have nature in your cities, but if it's not safe, it's not accessible, if when you get there's no path to walk on, you know, people are not going to benefit from those turnaround moments that I think we all get when we connect with nature.
So you mentioned that you felt that international organizations were not really paying enough attention to the role of cities in conservation. Why do you think that is, and do you see any particular pathways to improvement of that situation?
It's hard to understand given just the sheer scale of what cities control now, just in terms of the global economy, in terms of the number of people and voters that they house. But I think it comes from the fact that cities were created to be something other than nature. And I think that almost race memory, if you want, has stuck with us. And I can remember that during my undergraduate years when people were talking about what we would pick up on our postgraduate studies, what kind of things we want to pursue. Everyone saw the idealized conservation role as something that happened out in Botswana and the great vast areas of Africa. They didn't see it happening in their backyard. And that's because the backyard is not seen as wild or natural. And so I think we've got a real problem that cities were created to be something separate from nature. And I don't think we've moved ourselves into a new 20th century understanding of the role that cities now play in our lives. They're no longer keeping out the wild beasts. They are, in fact, the key architecture of our society, and our society requires engagement with nature at some levels. And so, you know, if you have that worldview and you are, you know, leading global assessments, you're not going to see cities as important. But also global assessments don't operate at the scale of the cities. You know, cities are almost invisible when you're looking at global level change. And that's where I think we need vertical integration in our thinking, is I think we can think about how the earth is changing, but we only want to understand that because we want to be able to act to change the trajectory of that change, to make it more suitable to our sustainable development needs. And that action requires a geography. Every action happens in a place, and money and people are now located in cities. And I don't think that full value chain has been established yet. If you're interested in really changing things, you've got to change things where people are. And so, you know, a lot of this work has focused on international negotiations between nation states. And yes, we talk about action there, and certainly nation states are important players. But at the end of the day, the coalface is where people live, where people work, where people make their life decisions, and that's cities. I also think part of the problem is that if one assumes that that is the value chain, that we need to understand how the world is changing and where action happens, a lot of national governments don't necessarily want to hear that politically, because that really raises the importance of local government. And I think, you know, there are many nation states around the world that feel uncomfortable with the idea of that much power vesting in a level that is local rather than national. So I think you've got some geopolitical issues that come into play. So I think it's a very complex mix to break down. Cities not part of nature, not fully understanding that if you want to act on global problems, it will often require local action. And if one does realize that, you know, not wanting to accede to the fact that a lot of power and resources would need to devolve to the local level to drive that action, because that begins to upset the political bandwagon in some places. So I think it's a very complex mix to break down.
You probably won't know the answer to this question, but let me just give it a stab just in case. What you said now just made me wonder whether decentralized countries might be having more success or be doing more progressive or proactive work in terms of biodiversity in cities, you know, the kind of thing that we've been talking about. Do you have any idea if that might be the case?
I haven't seen any literature on that directly, so I've got to revert to my own very practical experiences as a local government official. I mean, if you look at the African continent, South Africa certainly, if we are not the most decentralized, we are certainly amongst the most decentralized. And there you've seen cities really empowered by that process. And so a lot of the more innovative work has actually happened at the local level. If we're thinking about the biodiversity work in cities like Cape Town and Durban, certainly the climate change work, a lot of that really originated, so the action-based work originated at local government. And that practical experience has deeply influenced the way that national government thinks about these things now. So the decentralization has allowed local government to do, but also to carry that messaging back to national government. And we've been fortunate, because we are decentralized, that national government was happy to talk to us about that. So, you know, I think that creates an important to and fro dynamic, almost a kind of circular economy of knowledge, which has allowed us to bring that thinking in. So now we've got things like the city support program from our national treasury, where they are asking local governments about how we incorporate, for example, climate change issues into the support that treasury brings. And that's because of that dialogue that's been allowed to happen, compared to, you know, some other countries on the African continent. And I know a very good example, I won't name the city or the country, where we were doing some climate change works with colleagues, and they had the most unusual set of circumstances. Their national government, so that's a very centralized state, had commissioned a city plan to be developed, but it wasn't developed in country or in city. A group of Italian consultants were hired, and in Italy were drawing up a plan for this particular city, which would then just be delivered to that local government by national. And I mean, that's just a deeply unworkable set of circumstances if you're thinking about dealing with challenges of informality, improving resilience and adaptation, to have that very centralized procedure where central government is so out of touch with local realities that it thinks hiring Italian consultants is a good idea. So, you know, my practical experience suggests that decentralized allows more progress. Is that progress rapid enough? Is it at scale enough? I think the answer to that question globally is no. But it does indicate that that's probably a better route than a more centralized government.
Just aside from the centralization or decentralization question, I guess that given limited resources, it's difficult to justify, or it can be difficult to justify, allocating conservation money to cities. This could go for climate change as well, I guess, although that maybe is a little bit more of a special case, because cities are so clearly a central part of the issue there. But in the case of biodiversity and conservation, how does one justify allocating more to cities when rare species and ecosystems are being lost mostly elsewhere? And I know that you're going to start by reminding me that you pointed out that a lot of cities are in biodiversity hotspots, but I guess what I'm thinking about is contrasting cities with the vast expanses of especially the tropical world that are being lost at quite a rapid rate, and with them, you know, real storehouses of species. So how do we make that case?
Well, the first thing is, and not to directly answer your question with my first comment, but I think an important point for this conversation we're having is we can't separate out those global agendas anymore. To my mind, the biodiversity and climate change agenda are part of just one agenda. And I think there's an artificial separation which doesn't serve either of those agendas well if we think of them as separate. So I think if you are going to invest, we need to be investing in both in cities. But, you know, to go to your example, yes, there are vast areas of the tropical world that are under tremendous threat. And why is that? It's because the central decision makers sitting in remote capitals are so distant from those areas, they're not important. They don't know those ecosystems. They don't understand them. They're not connected with the communities who are directly reliant on those ecosystems. So that umbilical cord has been broken, and you're never going to be able to move all of your big decision makers who control the resources, the power, to live in these areas. The only hope you have is to bring them closer to nature in the cities. And by doing that, you create a populace that, if they have access to it and understand the value, will vote for those things. And so you create a political economy where the decision maker has direct experience of nature and therefore is more likely to be concerned when they hear about faraway places being cut down or burnt or degraded. But even if that doesn't happen, becomes much more wary of a population who's educated about these and who might feel that way as well. And so that, to my mind, we've got to be absolutely politically strategic. Unless you invest in biodiversity in cities and create awareness amongst the people who vote people into power, of the importance of nature, no one is ever going to care about remote places that the majority of us will never, ever get to visit. And that, singly alone, that very selfish reason is the key reason I believe you need to invest in biodiversity and cities. Probably equally important is the fact that these kind of natural systems, if we talk about things like climate change, bring an increased adaptive capacity and resilience that we can't necessarily get out of our grey infrastructure. So by using our green and our grey together, we open up options in terms of, you know, how we can respond to extremes, how we can respond to slow onset events like droughts and so on. So I think it opens up that opportunity of a new form of urban design, which is better suited to a constantly changing future. But because ecosystems have been around a lot longer than we have, they better adapted to change in many cases. And so they can become more cost-effective ways of dealing with the change that we as the human species have come. So I think in terms of political necessity, it's an absolute no-brainer. You are never going to protect those faraway places unless your decision makers sitting in capitals feel either a connection to nature or know that their population does and will vote them in or out, depending on that. I think it's important in terms of urban design because it creates options for how you can construct urban areas in new ways. And I think it opens up options for more cost-effective urban design. So really, it's an absolute no-brainer. But I also think, you know, in terms of influencing policymakers, the administration of cities are very important conduits of information in terms of bringing that into the decisions that we're asking our policymakers to take. I had a good laugh with our current mayor. He was telling me when he was a ward councillor way back in the 2000s, just how troubled he and other councillors were by my strong position that in the upgrading of an informal settlement, we worked to protect a riverine corridor to protect the frogs in that area, and how disconcerted he was at that time. But he now realizes how important that kind of stand was, and he now stood with me in believing that was important. And so we had gone from a point of, you know, having strong disagreement about an approach to urban development to one of very strong solidarity. And that came through a strong and convincing transfer of knowledge from an administration, which I think is important for policymakers to be exposed to. Because you must remember, you know, you're going to take them out into nature maybe once or twice. I mean, their timescales don't, or diaries don't allow that. But if they are constantly exposed to that input from the administration and informed input, an air of conviction coming out of the administrators, that too is a very compelling in my experience. And so, you know, the people that we don't often think about as critical champions for biodiversity, city administrators, I think they are incredibly powerful because they are the way you literally almost drip irrigate this kind of information into the policies arena. And very often policymakers will change with elections, but administrators often stay for a very long period of time. And so, you know, I think there are these underexplored and underutilized resources. Maybe what we need to be doing is spending an equal amount of time building champions amongst our otherwise faceless city administrators.
Do you mean particularly environmental administrators, or are you talking about people across different departments?
It has to be across them all. I mean, certainly in our early climate work, we knew when we were introducing the idea of climate change that we were going to see many furrowed brows and vexed faces. And so we realized that we would have to create champions in other line departments to help us carry this new message into the administration and into the policy and political realm. And so we immediately turned to our engineers and found, you know, a couple of key people there who understood the message. And then they began to carry it out. And that begins a process of moving the information through the administration. You know what it's like in a city environment when the environmental department speaks, everyone sort of rolls their eyes and yawns. But when the engineering department speaks, then ears pick up. But when the treasurer speaks, then you know the deal. And that's ultimately where we ended up. Our current city treasurer is probably one of our strongest champions, both on the climate change and biodiversity side. But that's come from low-level administrators like myself kind of plugging away every year with this messaging. And it eventually seeps through. So I think you've got to have those champions throughout the line departments.
I've always been just amazed by the energy that you put into this work. How do you motivate others who just sort of find it a bit daunting and who don't see progress happening simply because probably they haven't put enough time into the project yet?
That's a question I've been asked so many times. How do you keep going is always the first part of that question. And then how do you make others pick up on that? And I think we've all got different roles. I mean, my own personal motivation is I think you only get one life and you've got to do the best you can with whatever tools and resources you've been blessed to have. And so I just keep plugging away. That's just in my nature. But I think that energy can be infectious, and you don't need necessarily everyone to be running two jobs and having no life, but you do want other people's to be inspired, to be able to make choices in the course of their day-to-day lives that are somewhat different. And I think just by having that optimism and that energy that things can change and that they're not all immediately going to change overnight and that some of these things will take slightly longer, and allowing people to feel all right with that, because I think people can feel, particularly in this era now associated with COVID and climate change and biodiversity loss, people feel very helpless in their day-to-day lives. And I think it's just, you know, seeing someone like yourself who believes that things can change, who is happy to provide you with information about how you might play a role in your life in affecting that change. So, you know, my role in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we're doing all the great global assessment work that the IPCC is known for. My technical support unit is also working to produce a very user-friendly document just for people living in Durban to know what they can do, you know, in their day-to-day choices about where they hang their washing, how they drive their car, and so on. So I think it's that combination of events. Be out there, you know, lead from the front, be happy to share information, try and make that information as accessible as possible. And I think that's all you can do. Some people will pick up on it more than others, but, you know, no piece of activity is ever lost. It all adds to an increased momentum towards change.
A big thanks to Deborah for fitting that into her schedule, which she tells me has become even more hectic under COVID-19 restrictions. Please take a look at the episode notes for links to information on some of the things that we discussed or referred to. Next time I'll be talking about invasive alien species. These plants, animals, and other organisms together constitute one of the five main drivers of biodiversity loss worldwide. So the overarching question I'll be asking is somewhat controversial. Are they always undesirable? Or are there some situations in which they might do more good than harm? I'll be asking Martin Schlepfer, an ecologist at the University of Geneva. He shares my concern about the invasive alien species problem as a whole, but he doesn't believe that they all ought to be damned unconditionally. I hope you can join us as we try to untangle this thorny issue.